So thank you for the introduction, and I would like to start by thanking the organizers for inviting me to give this talk. It's certainly a pleasure to speak about some of the results that we've managed to prove about a particular probability model on plane partitions, which we call a whole Littlewood process. So to sort of quickly introduce the object, we're going to consider a probability distribution on plane partitions, which has the following form. So we have r to the volume. So r is a volume parameter. It's a number in the interval 0, 1. And we're going to modify this by multiplying by an integer polynomial and a second variable t. So I should mention that this model was first introduced by Vuletich in 2009. So we want to understand the behavior of this model in, when the parameters go to certain critical values. And the way that we study this is by first connecting this measure to what's called a whole Littlewood process. So it's a special case of the McDonald process for people that know what that is. And basically, the algebraic framework that we utilize is some degeneration of the first McDonald difference operator to obtain a class of observables that we combine in a generating series that we call the T-Laplace transform. And the formulas that we get are going to be in terms of certain Fredholm determinants that we can do asymptotic analysis with. Okay, so the structure of the talk is as follows. I'm going to carefully explain what the model is and what we can say about it. After that, I'll make the connection between the definition and how we define the connection with whole Littlewood processes. And finally, I'll explain how you use the difference operators to extract information and say a little bit something about the asymptotics in the end. Okay, so let's fix some notation. This is the definition of a plane partition. It's just a doubly infinite array of non-negative integers that are decreasing along rows and columns. Alternatively, you can visualize it as a filling of a Young diagram with numbers, so you have this decreasing along rows and columns property. Or you can sort of think of it geometrically as a stack of boxes in the corner. So these two are supposed to very obviously correspond to each other. The volume is just the number of boxes that are contained in this picture, or the sum of the entries in this one. And a nice way to think about plane partitions is basically you look at the diagonals of this diagram and you see that the numbers form decreasing sequences. So this means that they are regular partitions and they have to satisfy some interlacing property, which just means that, let's say interlacing means that this quantity should be bigger than this one, bigger than the one below, bigger than the one to the right, the one below, and so on. Okay? So this is sort of standard terminology. So let's introduce something more specific. We're going to consider connected components of this picture. So basically, if cells have the same number, the same entry, and they share an edge, we're going to connect them, and we're going to consider the largest connected component. So these components very naturally correspond to the gray balconies you see here in this picture. And we'll denote the number of components by k pi, which in this case is 7, as you can probably count. So let's make things a little bit more colorful. We're going to assign some levels to the different cells within a component. So let's look at the big component here in the middle. Each cell, you measure the distance, the diagonal distance to the boundary. So for example, for this one, you have 2 cells on the diagonal. And we're going to assign it a level of 2. And for this one, you have 3 cells, so you assign it a level of 3. And this gives you some coloring of the component. And we're going to consider connected components of the same level, which we call border components. So you have a nice big border component of level 1, 2 smaller border components of level 2, and a very tiny border component of level 3. Now this is some sort of a geometric picture, and we would like to assign to such a picture some polynomial. So to each connected component, every time you see a level I border component, you get an additional factor of 1 minus t to the I. So if you consider ni, so ni is the number of ith level Borg components inside of a given component C, then you define the polynomial with this simple formula. And now, to define the polynomial for the whole partition, you just take the product over the different components. So for the example that you have here, let's say you look at level 2 Borg components. You see you have 1, 2, and a small one, 3. So you have 3 level 2. Each level 2 gives you a factor of 1 minus t squared, and because there's 3 of them, you get this factor. And this is the polynomial that corresponds to this picture. So the point is that the a pi is some kind of a polynomial that captures some of the geometry of the plane partition. So the measure that we're going to consider is given, as I said, by r to the volume times this a pi of t. And you notice that if t is in negative 1, 1, this polynomial is just non-negative by steric. So this defines a certain weight. And the sum of the weights, or the partition function, was calculated by Vuletich to equal this nice product formula. And this is some sort of a generalization of the famous McMahon formula. Okay? So what is known about this measure? So there are two special cases that people have more intensely studied. So one is the case when t is equal to 0. So if t is 0, all of these polynomials just become 1s, and you get the usual r to the volume measure. So this special case has a nice algebraic structure. It can be expressed as a Schur process, which has a determinantal point structure, as is shown by Okunkov and Rozhetykhin. And you can get sort of concise formulas for the correlation kernel that you can analyze asymptotically. So here, critical value is when r goes to 1. So letting r go to 1 shifts the weight to bigger and bigger partitions. The typical linear size is 1 over 1 minus r. And if you scale in all three dimensions by 1 over n, you're going to see a three-dimensional limit shape emerge, as is shown by Cerf and Kenyon, the classical result. And also, if you focus on, let's say, the bottom slice, you can get the fluctuations around the limit shape. So if you remove the limit shape and scale by n to the negative 1/3, you get the convergence to the Airy process, as was shown by Ferrari and Spahn. So the other case that people have sort of considered is t equals negative 1. And in this case, you don't have a determinantal point structure, but you get a Pfaffian point structure. So now you can calculate the correlation kernel, and it's going to be in terms of some Pfaffian. And you can do asymptotic analysis. You can find the limiting density and at least have some formula for the limit shape. But the edge fluctuations, for example, are not known in this case. So what I'm going to be talking about today is the same measure when t is in the open interval 0, 1. So the thing that's more difficult in this case is that you lose this algebraic structure that you used to have when t is 0. So it used to be a determinantal point process, and you lose this, or at least we don't recognize it anymore. And so we have to use different techniques. And the techniques that we're going to use are going to limit our knowledge to only understanding the bottommost slice of this picture. So we cannot really access any information about the top part here. But nevertheless, we can try and understand what is happening to the bottom slice as parameters go to their critical values. And we're going to consider two cases. So in the first case, this parameter t is going to be fixed, and we're going to let r go to 1. So again, this corresponds to shifting the weight to bigger and bigger partitions. And now what's remarkable is that the bottom slice doesn't really see this dependence on t. So why is this remarkable? So you can calculate the volume, the expectation of the volume of this three-dimensional picture, and you can calculate its variance, and you can see that deterministically the volume goes to some function of t when you scale the right weight. So the three-dimensional picture does change with t, and in fact this can be seen with simulations. However, the bottommost slice stays the same, and not only is the limit shape the same, but the fluctuations of the first order and to the 1/3 stay the same as well. So they completely ignore the t dependence, which is was at least surprising to us. Now, the other case that we consider is when both t and r go to 1. And it's probably not clear by, the way I talked about the measure, why this is it should be an interesting case. So letting r go to 1 moves weight to bigger partitions. Letting t go to 1 moves it to smaller ones. In fact, if you just set t equals to 1, you get the delta measure at the empty partition. So hopefully when these parameters scale to 1 in some critical fashion, you're going to see a phase transition because you have competing ideas here. And the phase transition is not on the level of limit shape. The limit shape is going to stay the same, but the fluctuations will change. And what's going to happen is that you're going to transition from the Tracy-Witten distribution to the KPZ. So that's what's going to happen. Before I state the exact results, let me show some pictures that support what I've said. So these are just some simulations with different values of t. You can view this as a bird's-eye view of the three-dimensional diagram and rotate it in Russian style. So the red line, I don't know if it's visible, is red, but this should be the limit shape that we're expecting. And what one can see is that really the behavior doesn't change with varying t. So you see sort of the exact same picture. So what's the first result? Again, we're going to fix t, 0, 1. And we're going to fix a tau, which is non-zero. This is a technical assumption. And now the quantity that we're interested in is this lambda 1 prime of tau n. So in this diagram, what this means is that you move a distance tau n away from the main diagonal, and you count the number of boxes in this vertical line. So you look at this quantity, you remove the limit shape, and you scale by a constant times n to the 1/3. So this is the usual thing that one does. And this thing converges to the GUE Tracy-Whittam distribution. And this is somehow expected because the GUE Tracy-Whittam arises as edge fluctuations to tiling problems, and plane partitions are just lozenge tilings of the plane. Now, here's a picture that's supposed to represent what is happening as T is becoming large. So basically, here you have sort of very packed lines. So this is a zoomed-in profile of a three-dimensional diagram, if it's not clear. And what happens is that the bottom slices become more sparse. And they become more separated. And hopefully this will motivate that, the behavior is starting to change. And when t is indeed very close to 1, you're going to see things unraveling and see some qualitative change in the behavior. Yes.
By virtue of the definition of the measure, these lines have some Gibbs property.
Yes. So you can condition on adjacent lines and resample the middle one, and it's going to not change the measure. That's a type of Gibbs property. Yeah, actually, yes. So
resampling is what's the exact measure on resampling?
So basically, you're gonna the resampling is something like q to the number of up steps of your walk. So that's the measure, and you resample according to this distribution, and the induced measure is going to be the same. Now, with the varying t, you're going to have sort of a potential term, but that is going to disappear in the limit when t is fixed. When t is not fixed, it's actually going to stay in the limit, and there are some conjectures along this line. I can get back afterwards and talk about this. But, there's more structure. I'll get to it. Okay, so what's the other sort of asymptotic behavior here? So again, we have these n and alpha as before. You have the same quantity lambda 1 prime. You again subtract the exact same limit shape. The scaling seems different, but it's actually the same. This is going to be of the same order as n to the negative 1/3. So really, this is kind of similar to the last quantity we have, except that now you have a logarithmic shift in n. And now if you do this scaling, this is going to converge to the Hofkohl solution, to the KPZ equation with narrow edge initial data. So let me explain this a little bit more carefully. So in this limiting regime, we're letting both t and r go to 1. If t goes to 1, log of t goes to 0, and this also goes to 0. And we want this to happen in a critical fashion so that this ratio remains a constant kappa. The t that appears in the limit is a function of kappa and alpha. So it depends on how much away from the diagonal you moved and how quickly does t go to 1 with as r goes to 1. And based on these two quantities, this distance from the main diagonal, tau, and this kappa, you have the scaling is fixed, and you see the result. Okay. So this is sort of the conclusion of the first part of the talk. I'm now going to shift gears and talk more about how this measure arises as a whole little bit process. So yes. What is tau? Right. So tau is just a real number. So basically, you move a distance proportional to n away from the diagonal, because that's the scale in which you're moving. And tau is just what is the scale of n in which you're moving away from the diagonal. So again, tau n is just the distance that you're moving here, and the quantity that you're interested in is the number of boxes in this vertical slice. Is it somewhat clear? It's just a parameter that measures, because you have many slices here, right? I mean, you can look at this one, or you can look at this one, and tau parameterizes which one you're looking at, basically.
And big T?
And big T is it's explicitly given by as a function of tau. So alpha is a function of tau, and hence this one is a function of tau. And it also depends on kappa, which was the rates, the rigged rate, you know, fixed rate at which the parameters scale. So they go to the critical values in a critical fashion that we measure by kappa, and T reflects both kappa and the tau dependence. And in here is just the time in the solution to the KPZ equation. The choice of parameter is made so that T appears in this expression because it appears in the KPZ equation.
May I ask a stupid question? So the Hopf-Cole solution of capital X, it's a shifting of the interface. Does this matter? So you have capital X equals zero in the formula.
Right.
Does this matter?
No. So, this is a one-point convergence result, right? And you have the distributions are equal with.
So f of t, t comma zero is roughly the same distribution as f of t comma one.
No, so there is a deterministic shift, but this shift can be incorporated into the scaling. So the choice of zero is only to make formulas seem concise.
But so you can get non-zero.
You can get non-zero by moving away some 2 to the 2/3 away. Right. As long as you're only focusing on one point convergence results, you can get all the x's that you want, right? Not for multiple points, though, unfortunate. Any other questions before I proceed? First, let me recall sort of this sure process paradigm by Okonkwo, Fener, Shetykin. And this corresponds to the case t equals zero, in which case the probability is just r to the vol. So we consider pairs of sequences of partitions. So lambda is just the sequence lambda k. And we define the weight of this pair as just the product, the infinite product of skew-Schur polynomials. So if you don't know what a skew-Schur polynomial is, I've written down the formula. These are single variable specializations, so everything is very simple. So it's going to be zero unless lambda and mu interlace. And if they do interlace, it's just x to the power of number of boxes in the skew diagram. So now these parameters, you have infinitely many parameters. If you pick them to be numbers in 0, 1, then this infinite product is well defined. So it could be 0, but it's a non-negative quantity that is well defined. And then if the sum of the weights is finite, then you can define the probability distribution as just the ratio of the weight over the sum of the weights in the usual way. And this is called the Schur process, or at least a special case of the Schur process. I should mention that this construction generalizes vastly. So you can replace Schur polynomials with more general symmetric polynomials, like the MacDonald polynomials. You can generalize these single variable specializations to more general specializations. And you can get a lot of models out of it, as you probably know. Now, this gives me a measure on sequences or pairs of sequences of partitions, and what I want is a measure on plane partitions. But a plane partition is just a sequence itself. So let me just show this again by a picture. This is a plane partition. And if you look at the diagonals, you look at this one, the diagonals, it's given by this interlacing sequence. Okay? So what we want is to pick parameters x and y so that the projection onto the first coordinate is exactly supported on sequences of this type, and such that the measure is exactly proportional to r to the volume. And this is the specialization of parameters that work. Okay, so it's probably not clear to people who have never seen this construction before, but you should notice that xn is either r to some power, or it's zero, and the y's are either zero or r to some power. So what this means is that in this infinite product, you're either getting a zero or r to some power. And you're going to get zero exactly when the partitions don't interlace. And if they do interlace, you're just going to get a product of a bunch of r's. And you just have to check that the exponent exactly matches the volume. So this is an easy exercise, and basically it works. an important property that we have now is that, well, once you show that you can realize a measure as a sure process, for example, you get a lot of algebraic structure that you can utilize. So one nice property is that you can get the distribution of the kth diagonal. So you have a measure on a sequence, you can project onto the kth element of that sequence, and you can ask what's the measure there. If you started with just a three-dimensional picture, that's a hard question. But once you know it's a sure process, you get this nice formula by just utilizing some of the properties of symmetric functions. And if you don't know what a sure symmetric function is, it's just you can think of it as a polynomial in infinitely many variables, and there are no convergence issues because the variables are decaying, you know, exponentially fast. Okay? And this property is going to lift. In fact, it lifts to even the McDonald case, but that's not important for our purposes. So what about the general case? So in the general case, we used to have the weight being some S's of X's and Y's, and now what we're going to do is we're going to replace these by a P's and Q's, depending on whether the variables is X's, Y's. So this is what happens. You replace this S lambda of X in the previous formula with a P lambda of X T. And what this does, well, you replace this polynomial with the exact same one, except that you get an additional factor, of which is a polynomial in T. And for the Q case, you're going to get a different factor, which is phi of lambda mu. So what do these polynomials look like? Again, this is supposed to just give people a flavor of what these expressions look like. There's products of fairly simple factors, 1 minus t to some power. And the product is over some sets, I and j, that depend on lambda and mu. So these are the definitions, but the point is that they depend on lambda and mu in some fairly non-trivial fashion, but not really too much. So what's going to happen now? If we specialize the variables in the same way, then because we have the same factors here as the sure case, we're going to get the exact same R to the volume. But now we've picked up extra factors, which are some polynomials in T. So the general distribution will now be proportional to the R to the volume times some polynomial. And what's remarkable is that this polynomial is the same as the one that I started with. So this is kind of really remarkable. Because a priori, you're taking a big product of polynomials that, there's no expectation that when you take the infinite product, even though it's going to be finite, you can read off the structure of the polynomial from the three-dimensional diagram. So if you only knew this formula, then, I gave you a three-dimensional diagram, you have to look at pairs of adjacent diagonals and calculate the phis and psis and then take a big product. Whereas the A of pi had this really nice geometric structure that you can just, color the border components and very quickly pick up the factors that are relevant. And as I said, this property is now going to extend, the one that we have before, that if you project onto the kth component, you're going to have that the weight is proportional to now whole little with symmetric functions. So this is the thing we want to study. This is the object that we want to study, and the way to study is by first making number of variables finite. So we're going to consider measures of this form, x's and y's are in 0, 1. And then when, we're going to get some formulas about this, and we're going to let the number of variables go to infinity to get formulas for expression like this. So that's going to be our strategy. So what is the general philosophy when you're dealing with something like this? So the starting point is the Cauchy identity. So the whole little with the symmetric polynomial satisfy this identity, which is even a numeric identity if xi and y are in 0, 1. And so the sum over lambda of p lambda times q lambda is equal to this nice product formula. And now what we want to find is an operator D, which is diagonalized by the whole little with polynomials, meaning that they're eigenfunctions with an eigenvalue some d of lambda. And this deal of lambda is going to carry some information about lambda for us. And then if we apply this d k times to both sides, we're going to get this expression. And we want to divide by pi. So now p lambda times q lambda was the weight. Pi is just the sum of the weight. So if you take the ratio, you get exactly the probability of lambda. So you just get the expectation of this variable. And this is what we call an observable. And on this side, you get some expression, which you hope you can understand. So what is an operator that works? So as I said, we're going to work with the degeneration of the first McDonald difference operator. If you don't know what that is, I've written down the definition here. basically you have these t, so these are linear functions in the space of functions and then variables that basically act on a function by setting the ith variable to zero. That's what all they do. And then you multiply by a factor and you sum over all I. So this is a nice linear operator on the space of functions. And what's crucial about it is that it's diagonalized by the p lambda. So basically, if you apply it to p lambda, you get an eigenvalue. And what we see from this eigenvalue is that we've managed to pick up this lambda 1 prime, the largest column in our partition, which is the information that we can access. So now this is a bad eigenvalue because it contains n. And eventually, we're going to let n go to infinity. The number of variables goes to infinity. So we do an affine transformation to just replace this with a different eigenvalue. So nothing, you know, complicated is happening. We just want to get rid of this t to the n so that we don't kill the statistic that we're actually measuring. And so we do this, and we have this new operator dn. And this is the operator that we're going to put into our general philosophy.
Sorry, but that was strange.
Sorry?
So this does it. So you multiply by t minus 1 and then divide by t to the n. So
you add a 1, first of all.
Oh, yeah.
Add the 1, and that's what's going to save the day. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry.
No, it's fine.
That was working.
Right. So you put this back into our paradigm, and you have now that the expectation of d lambda to the k is equal to this operator applied to pi over pi. And d lambda is just t minus lambda 1 prime. And now you have a formula. You have some expression in terms of this, and now you want to understand what does this look like. And the proposition that I've written down basically says that this expression equals to this nested contour integral formula. So the exact form of this integral is not really important. I've included it so that people have a sense of what are the types of expressions that you have to work with when dealing with a problem. But I should remark on the contour. So let me use the board a little bit. Not this one. One of them should work. Okay. It's fine. I'll turn it off eventually. So you have these contours, right? So you start with a very big contour, which is C01, and then they are nested in each other. So somehow you have C0, let's say, k minus 1. So this dotted one is going to be T inverse C0k, and inside of it it's going to be C0k. Okay, so they're shrinking as k becomes large. And not only that, but you have to contain not only the innermost, the one with the biggest index, but also t inverse times it. So t is something in 0, 1. So this is something that's bigger. All of these contain 0 and the xi's. So they have to lie inside. And for the purposes of the proposition, you have that y's are very small, so that these quantities lie outside of the contour. Okay, so this is how the contours look, and this proposition, because we know that the expectation, maybe I should turn off this one. I don't know. Is this picture visible?
No, it's not. Can you, the last one.
The last one. Okay. Good. So. So now, basically, you know that this expression equals this one, and I just want to show that this is equal to this expression here. If I multiply by pi both sides, I get this, that I want to prove this thing. So, and the way to prove it is basically by induction on k. You look at this integrant as a function of zk, and what you notice is that the only pole, so you have poles that are potentially coming from this guy, but they do not enter into this picture. That's because of the way we chose the contours. You have additional poles which are coming from the yi's, inverse times t-inverse, but they also never enter in. So the only ones are coming from the xi's and the zero. And now if you expand, you basically use residue theorem to express the contour over c0k as a sum of the residues, you're going to essentially see the expression with k minus 1. This is the same expression with a k minus 1. It's not a hard calculation, but it's rather technical because of the formulas. And then basically you do this until you reach 1, and you do it one more time because, you can. So this is just, again, a sort of flavor of the types of arguments. There is no really complicated idea coming into here other than calculating residues. Yes?
So is the zero residue corresponding to adding one?
Yes, yes, that's exactly what's happening. So you're adding one, so you have to include the zero. That's right. Okay. So now what we have is a formula for the expectation of some kth moment. We want to add these, over k with some u to the k, or let's say k factorial, something like the Laplace transform. Right? We want to put these in a generating series. But this expression is bad. It's bad for two reasons. One is that these contours are distinct, and it's going to grow and grow. And so we would like to have the same contours appearing here. The other issue is that this formula only holds for y sufficiently small, which again depend on k. And so we would like to extend this result to all y's if possible. And the way to get around this is using this residue bookkeeping formula. So I'm just going to sort of explain roughly what's written here. On this side, you have nested contours like the one I have over here, over some expression. Now, on this side, you have a sum over some partitions of k with some prefactor. And now you have contours that are over the same contour, integrals over the same contour. But now these could be over fewer variables. So these could be, it could be a single contour or a double contour or multiple up to k integrals. And how do you prove something like this? I'll just explain what's happening. So you start off with this picture, and you start deforming these contours one at a time to be equal to the innermost one. Now, during the deformation, you're going to cross some poles. And crossing poles is essentially reducing the number of variables over which you're integrating. And it's basically going to produce additional summons here. And if you do an additional symmetrization, which is what this n factorials are doing, you can reformulate the integrand in terms of a nice determinant expression like this one. If you're clever enough, you just have to combine the different residue subspace integrations into a neat formula like this. So if you're interested, you can read this argument. It's in Borden, Ufedov, and Corwin. Basically, this is the ingredient that we need, as I've written down here. So all I've done here is I used the last expression and replaced it with what the residue bookkeeping formula gave me. And what we have managed to do is we've replaced all of these contours by the same one. That's one thing. And the other thing is that, we used to know this equality only for small y, but now we can extend it analytically for all y of interest. And so we have this result for all y in 0, 1. So we got rid of both of our restrictions in a nice way, and now we're going to multiply both of these by uk to the k over kt factorial. So kt factorial is this deformed factorial function. And the choice of this scale comes from the factor that the residue bookkeeping formula produces. And so it's somehow imposed upon us. And now if you sum these guys with these factors, you're going to get the T Laplace transform. And if you do the same with the other side, you can write it down as a Fredholm determinant. So this is the sort of, yes? Yes.
So these moments, so T is between 0 and 1, and the lambda primes are unbounded?
No. So that's the nice thing. So the you're dealing with finite length specialization. So the lambda 1 prime is at most the n. So there are no, these are, all moments are bounded, which is a nice thing, yes. If we were dealing with lambda 1, they could potentially be even infinite or growing exponentially fast. But these are actually, they're at most exponentially fast growing. So this can grow at most as t to the minus kn, right? So maybe the minus is confusing, but t is in 0, 1, so this is like a, right. So there are no really bad things happening here, surprisingly enough. And if you're careful, you're not even going to see any poles or anything like that happening in when you do the Fredholm determinant. And so this is the typical kind of Mellin-Barnes type of integral representation. And it's the formula that you need. So this is a finite length formula. You can let n go to infinity and get a formula for infinitely many variables. there, you know, letting the number of variables go to infinity is completely harmless. It's just going to, you know, make this product infinite, which is fine. It's very rapidly converging. And now with this formula, you can actually try and do the asymptotic analysis. So if t is fixed and you let r go to 1, this expectation is going to become the expectation of an indicator function. And this Fredholm determinant, is the kernel is going to converge to the Airy kernel. And you're going to see basically the GOE Tracy Witten distribution. Now, if you let t and r go to 1 in the critical fashion that I explained, then this will become, you know, this t Laplace transform becomes the usual Laplace transform. And this Fredholm determinant becomes the Laplace transform of the partition function for the continuous directed random polynomial. So there are existing formulas for these that are in terms of Fredholm determinants that we can match. And now convergence of the Laplace transforms implies weak convergence. And then when you take the logarithm, you can connect the quantity that we're interested in, this lambda 1 prime properly scaled, with the free energy of the continuous directed random polymer, which is exactly the solution to the KPZ equation. So it seems like I have a little bit of time. So what I've told you is basically what we can prove. So let me try and say what we would maybe like to prove, or what other extensions of these results we have. Yes? So we let them be A times R to the I. So these were, if you recall, the measure that we wanted to study was this one. And we basically fixed finite number of parameters. And when we want to go to this one, you just let xi be a times r to the I minus 1, and you let them go to infinity.
I have a question. So lambda k here in this. So is this measure not depending on k? I mean, the right-hand side does not depend on k, strangely.
It depends on k. So there's an a which depends on k. Oh, I've hidden it very well, I guess. Other questions?
No, yeah,
oh, it's fine. Good. So as I said, the measure really makes sense for t in the open interval minus 1, 1. And all I've talked about is 0, 1. So one immediate question is, can anything like this go through for negative t? So, and at least the finite length formulas appear to hold. But then you run into some issues when you do the infinite sum in the Fredholm determinant expansion. And there are many issues. Let me point to at least one. So one issue is, for example, this t to the minus s. So if t is negative, you're running into difficulties with analyticity because you're typically working with the principal branch of the logarithm. There's also difficulty in that this infinite Hummer symbol is not converging to the indicator function if t is negative. So you have to somehow maybe come up with a different function to analyze, or, you know, completely different idea. I don't know. And t negative is actually interesting because we believe there is a different phase transition when t goes to negative 1. There is a certain contraction that is happening in the geometry that you can even pick up on in simulation. So there is actually something going on there, which might be interesting to understand. Now, the results that we have can be, you know, only say anything about the bottom slice. So we would like to access information about the top part of these diagrams, right? So can we access any information about these other lines in the picture? Because all we really can say is something about the bottom one. At the very least, is there a limit shape? So again, you run a simulation, you see a limit shape, and, you know, it's changing with t. But what is it exactly? So that's a nice question. Okay, our results say something about one-point convergence. Can we do two or multiple point convergences to show that the bottom slice converges to the Airy process when t is fixed, or to the KPZ equation when t goes to 1? That would match, for example, if t is fixed, would match the result by Ferrari and Schwab to the convergence of the Airy process. Okay, we can be even more bold. So we have convergence about the bottom slice. What about the upper slices? So, you know, these really look like line ensembles if you look at them. It's not an accident. These pictures are made to sort of visualize this. So can we show, for example, that if you look at the k adjacent slices in this picture, they converge. So again, conjecturally, this should converge to the Airy process, which is the bottom line of the Airy line ensemble. So can we show that this converges to the area line ensemble in the sense of line ensembles, for example. And we can, you know, let's say match something like the Brown and Gibbs property. So we can do the resampling, and we can see that on the scales at which, you know, things deport, the contribution of the T, provided that it's fixed, is disappearing in the limit. So we can at least match something like that, and the non-intersection is automatically imposed to us by the non-intersection of these paths. And in the KPZ equation, well, again, we have something like a line ensemble. So it's slightly more complicated to visualize, but there's going to be some deterministic logarithm of n times n to the 1/3 shift that's going to flip the picture over. And then somehow we're saying that the top line should be going to KPZ, and then these other lines should be going to the other lines of the KPZ line ensemble. So the point is that there appear to be a lot of more questions, you know, than previously thought about this model, and it appears to be a fairly rich model to analyze. And I guess on this remark, I will end my talk.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions, comments?
Yes.
One obvious question is: are there dynamics that act on these?
That is an interesting question. So these are stationary models, and there is no notion of time for some reason. It's so what you can try and do, for example, is somehow slice this up and then try and look at this as interlacing arrays and see if there's a way to make dynamical sense out of this. But you know, the way we really thought about this problem was a stationary problem. The polynomial a pi of t has a geometric interpretation. We don't really know whether it comes from some sort of a dynamic. And it seems like to sort of be like a potential in which repulses certain kinds of configuration. But it's certainly worthwhile investigating. I mean, the very fact that the KPZ arises suggests that you should try and look for some sort of a particle interpretation of this model. Yes?
Is there any physical motivation for the model, original model?
So, well, the usual model, which is just R to the volume, is a very natural thing to consider. So you can view these things as just, you know, particles that are being arranged in some configuration. And, you know, the R to the volume corresponds that if you condition on the number of particles being fixed, you get the uniform measure over all possible arrangements. These additional polynomials do is they sort of insert a certain kind of deformation of the weights. So certain weights are more preferred than others, and essentially it sort of corresponds to not wanting to see too big of separation between lines. So I'm not a physicist. I cannot really say whether this has an interpretation, but
motivation was fewer kind of get another integrable model, or motivation was
So I should mention that the model was suggested to be my advisor, Alexei Borodin. So it's not something that I came up with. It's something that other people have worked at. It was sort of passed down on me to see if I can use the difference operator to say something about it. I think that you can make physical sense out of it because it is, you know, some sort of picture that is like a, you know, particle arrangement on the one hand side. And, you know, the choice of the polynomials is not something that's, you know, something that you can never relate to the picture whatsoever. So let's say some function that has nothing to do. It has some geometric meaning, and maybe if I were a, you know, gifted physicist, I would be able to interpret this as some physical phenomenon. But
other questions, comments? If not, let's thank the speaker again.